Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Russia. As usual, I'm Damon, and this is episode 77, Russia Attacks. Okay, so last time out we witnessed the so-called diplomatic revolution of 1756, which saw a realignment of the major European powers, Great Britain and Prussia on the one side, and France, Austria and Russia on the other, and the start of the Seven Years' War. And closer to home in Russia, we followed Catherine's affair with the Polish Count Stanislaus Poniatowski. The Empress Elizabeth's latest illness and subsequent indisposition, Ivan VI's forced move from Kolmogory to Schlüsselburg, and the British ambassador, Sir Charles Hanbury-Williams, playing James Bond and passing information gleaned from Catherine and Bestuzhev to Frederick the Great of Prussia. In this episode, we'll be concentrating on the year 1757, and pretty much just on the Seven Years' War, mainly because for the first time in a long time, the Russian army gets to flex its muscles. So, no domestic intrigue or shenanigans this time around, all of that will have to be dealt with on another day. But before we get into all of that, just a quick reminder that this podcast is supported by the kind and generous members of the Boyar Duma. If you want to join them to get early access and ad-free versions of the main episodes, special members-only episodes, and written transcripts for around the price of a cup of coffee per month, then you can by subscribing to the Boyar Duma via Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And as always, check the episode notes for the details and links. Okay, if you're all set, let's get stuck into some history of Russia. And first of all, let's clarify what the term Seven Years' War actually means and what it actually includes, because for me, it's a bit of a mishmash. So traditionally, the Seven Years' War, fought between 1756 and 63, which is, when you tot it up, 8 years and not seven, is used as an umbrella term for a series of related theatres or conflicts that took place on both land and sea, primarily in Europe and North America, but also in Asia, Africa, and South America. But here's the mishmash bit. Some of the European conflicts have a separate name, and some don't. For example, the battles fought between Austria and Prussia in and around the territory of Silesia had their own name, the Third Silesian War. And the conflict between Prussia and Sweden in and around Pomerania has been labelled the Pomeranian War. However, the conflicts between Russia and Prussia and France and Prussia don't, as far as I can tell, have separate names. They're just referred to as the Seven Years' War. And outside of Europe, we have a similar situation. We have the French-Indian War, a series of conflicts that were fought between Great Britain and France and their respective North American colonies. And we also have the Third Carnatic War, which was fought between the same combatants in the Indian subcontinent. Whereas the fighting that took place in South America between the Spanish and Portuguese and the encounters between France and Great Britain in West Africa, again, as far as I can tell, don't. There, all of that may be of use to you, and there's no real harm done if it isn't. It's just, I'm afraid, another one of those minutes in your lives that you won't be getting back. Okay, with all of that more or less sorted, let's wing our way over to the heart of Europe, and specifically Saxony. It's spring 1757, and Frederick the Great, having rested his troops over the winter and having checked Austria's attempt to gain a foothold in Silesia, is keen to get on with the second part of his grand plan, i.e. occupy Bohemia. On the 6th of May, the combined Prussian and Saxon forces managed to win a major battle outside of Prague, the Austrians were forced back, and Frederick's army then laid siege to the city. And so surely it would only be a matter of time before Prague would fall and the Prussian army would march on its victorious way to Vienna. Except it didn't quite turn out that way. Maria Theresa, the Austrian Empress, quickly sent a relief force towards Prague, and Frederick, fearing that the siege would now take longer than he'd hoped, and hearing reports, probably from Henry Williams, of Russian mobilisation towards East Prussia, retreated back to Saxony. Now, Frederick's retreat from Prague was probably the right move, but if he thought he would be able to make a quick return to Bohemia and then continue on to Vienna, then he was to be very much mistaken. And that's because, sooner rather than later, he would be caught upon the numerous horns of a complex dilemma, or, to put it in more simple terms, he would soon come under attack from multiple directions. First to appear, as hinted at a minute ago, was the Russian army under the command of Field Marshal Stepan Apraksin. Now, Apraksin was in many respects the last person you would want to lead your troops into action. As a younger man, he'd gained some experience in Anna Ivanovna's Ottoman campaigns of the mid to late 1730s. However, in 1757, he was 55 and probably past his sell-by date. Described by none other than Henry Williams as good-natured, lazy and corpulent, Apraksin, who had only achieved his position out of loyalty to Bestuzhev, had fairly recently and annoyingly decided that a winter stroke early spring campaign against the Prussians was out of the question. His caution had been driven by the reality of the current internal political situation, which was essentially that if Elizabeth died, and the pro-Prussian Peter took over, then Frederick would no longer be Russia's enemy, and there'd be no need for Apraksin to be heading west at the head of an army. However, all that was, at the time, conjecture, and at the urging of St. Petersburg, by the middle of May 1757, the portly field marshal was on the road at the head of 75,000 troops. Well, actually, he was sitting comfortably in a carriage, as he was physically unable to ride a horse. His target was the Prussian port of Memel, and in particular, its fortress. By the way, if you look for Memel on a map, you won't find it, and that's because today it's known as Klaipeda or Klaipeda, and it's in Lithuania. The last time that a Russian army had been used in anger was back in 1741 against the Swedes, and no one was quite sure how this one would perform, even though it was estimated that Apraksin's forces outnumbered the Prussian forces located in the area by almost 3-1. And they needn't have worried. At the end of June, following a 5-day artillery bombardment, Memel was taken, and this was followed up in the August by a Russian victory at the Battle of Gross-Jägersdorf. The road to the East Prussian capital, Königsberg, lay open. Except that Apraxin didn't take it. Instead, after hanging around doing nothing for 2 to 3 weeks, he retreated. And it wasn't just any old retreat. He dumped his wagons, he spiked his cannon, destroyed his ammunition and burnt villages and crops behind him as he hastily moved back to the safety of Memel. When reports of this reached St. Petersburg, the overall reaction was one of shock. No one could quite fathom out why Apraxin had acted in such a way, and soon all kinds of rumours were flying around. In some quarters, it was believed that Apraxin's retreat was down to the Field Marshal's concern for Elizabeth's health, and, as stated earlier, what would happen if she were to die and Peter were to take over. And this heightened concern was because in September, a somewhat recovered Elizabeth had collapsed publicly at a church service, with some suspecting that she had suffered a stroke. Others suggested that Apraxin's about turn had been driven by a lack of ammunition and supplies, and to a certain degree this made more sense. Russian armies were notoriously poorly supplied, and if Apraxin's forces were finding provisions hard to come by, then the best and perhaps only option would have been an orderly retreat. However, neither reason satisfied the French and Austrian ambassadors, whose nation's armies were fully occupied and invested in trying to defeat the Prussians. Bestuzhev, too, was now a worried man. The choice of Apraxin as commander had been his, and according to some reports, the Grand Chancellor was worried that the reason for the Russian army's mysterious retreat would be laid squarely at his door. Now, what happened next is all a bit strange. Supposedly, Bestuzhev then asked Catherine to write to Apraxin and urged him to get back on the front foot, which apparently she did 3 times. But to no avail. The letters were never answered, and Apraxin carried on with his retreat. And then another reason for the retreat came to the fore. Elizabeth apparently had been lucid enough to attend a session of the War Council, and when she read the latest reports from Apraxin, highlighting problems with supply, she had personally ordered the Field Marshal to head back to the safety of Memel without notifying Bestuzhev. Whatever the reason, things would not turn out well for Apraxin. In either late September or early October 1757, he was relieved of his command, and then ominously he was sent back to his estates to await further questioning. In fact, this whole affair would spell further danger for not only Apraxin, but Bestuzhev and Catherine. And we'll cover all of that in the next episode. For the here and now, though, we'll look at the much greater danger being faced by Frederick the Great from other points of the compass. In 1757, the Kingdom of Sweden still held territory in Pomerania on the southern Baltic coast, and the Hatz faction, remember them, who were still in power, saw Frederick's current situation as providing them with an easy opportunity to extend their borders southwards. And so in September, just as Apraxin was retreating, and with funding guaranteed by the French, Sweden declared war on Prussia. The early part of this particular conflict, which is, as we know, also known as the Pomeranian War, proved to be indecisive, and Frederick was able to contain the Swedish army's thrusts with relatively few troops. And of course, for the time being, he didn't need to worry about the Russians. However, the same couldn't be said about the situations that were developing out to his south and west. But before we take a look at those, it's time for a quick cup of tea.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay, we're back. In the last episode, I mentioned a German confederation that had been put together by the British, mainly to protect Hanover from the French. Well, that was a game that two could play. And in 1857, France collected together a number of the southern and western German territories and formed the Reichsarmee, which, together with the French army proper, now aimed its sights squarely at Hanover. The British-German Confederation Army was commanded by the British King George II's third son, Prince William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland, or, as he was better known, Butcher Cumberland. Now, the Duke had picked up this sobriquet in the aftermath of 1845's Jacobite uprising, mainly for his treatment of wounded Jacobite soldiers after the Battle of Culloden and the subsequent pacification of large areas of Highland Scotland. For the here and now, though, the Duke's British-German forces were faced by a much larger and superior French-German army, and at the Battle of Hastenbeck in July 1757, Cumberland was forced to retreat. His army headed towards the North Sea coast and waited for the British Navy to bring reinforcements and provisions. But at the time, the Navy was overstretched and busy elsewhere, and so unfortunately, the help never came. Now, George II had given his son discretionary powers to negotiate a separate peace, and, hemmed in by the French forces to his south and east, Cumberland felt that he had no choice, and on the 10th of September, he formally agreed to the French occupation of Hanover and the disbandment of his army. But despite what his father had said, Cumberland's decision did not go down at all well in London. Most, including the recently formed coalition government, thought that Cumberland should have put up a bit more of a fight. And after the event, George II was alleged to have said, "My son has ruined me and disgraced himself." And so not long afterwards, Cumberland resigned all of his military and public titles and retired to his country estates. Frederick the Great was mortified. With Hanover now out of the war and the British army disbanded, the French and their German allies had nothing to stop them from threatening Prussia's western borders. And what was worse, he soon received news that an Austrian army was now approaching Prussian territory from the south. Back in 1756, everything had started so well for the Prussian king, but here, just a year later, he was effectively surrounded by his enemies, Prussia to the east, Sweden to the north, France to the west, and now Austria to the south. And he was without any effective boots-on-the-ground support from his British ally. Well, that was the glass-half-empty view. The glass-half-full view went something like this. Okay, he was surrounded, but if you look at things a little closer, it's not that bad. Among his enemies, there's no centralised cohesive strategy or command and control. Russia's forces have retreated and don't seem to have any plans to get back on the offensive. And Sweden's army isn't large enough to do anything really serious and has been effectively contained or bottled up in Pomerania by a relatively small Prussian force. So, that leaves just France and its Reichsarmee and Austria to deal with. And even though the British can't help us directly, they're sending supplies via their navy, and their financial aid is absolutely crucial. Perhaps the best option for Frederick at this point would have been to open negotiations with the French and Austrians in an attempt to buy some time that would A, allow him to regroup and replan, and B, give Britain the opportunity to provide some kind of military relief, particularly against the French. But the more he thought about this course of action, the less he liked it. He would be negotiating from a position of weakness, and any advantage that he did manage to obtain would be short-lived and probably at too great a cost to Prussia's territorial holdings, i.e. he would probably have to give up Silesia. And as for the British, well, they talked a good war and came up with the cash, but they were able to do very little else. Attack was to be Frederick's best line of defence, and after a series of conferences with his commanders, he decided to go all in, and he came up with a new three-part plan which, if successful, would stop his enemies in their tracks. The most immediate danger came from the French and their Reichsarmee allies, which, made up of around 42,000 men, had, by early November, advanced into Saxony. On the 31st of October, the Prussians, who had assembled a much smaller force of approximately 22,000, so almost half the size of their enemy, intercepted the French near the village of Rossbach, and, following a series of feints, manoeuvres and artillery bombardments, by the morning of the 5th, battle lines were drawn and final preparations were being made. The actual fighting didn't start until 2:30 in the afternoon. Apparently, Frederick had made time for a sumptuous lunch. But around an hour and a half later, the Battle of Rossbach was over. It's estimated that French-stroke German losses during the battle were in the range of 8 to 9,000 men, killed, wounded or captured. Prussian casualties were less than 1,000. So how exactly had the smaller Prussian force prevailed? Well, there were a number of reasons. First of all, the Prussian forces were, as I've highlighted before, superbly equipped, provisioned, trained and drilled, and were generally considered to be, at the time, the best in Europe. Secondly, the Prussian army was under the unified and decisive command of Frederick, whereas the French and the Reichsarmee forces each had their own, more hesitant commanders. Charles, the Prince Soubise, a superb name by the way, who led the French contingent, and the Austrian Prince Saxe-Hildburghausen, that's an equally great name, who led the Reichsarmee. Thirdly, Frederick's manoeuvres immediately prior to the battle had lulled the normally conservative French and German commanders into a false sense of security. Plus, the battle itself was to take place on terrain that the Prussian king had chosen. And then finally, during the battle itself, Prussian leadership, tactics and execution were just simply better than those of the French and their German allies. Rossbach would prove to be something of a turning point in the Seven Years' War, and with this stunning victory under his belt, Frederick had sent a clear message, something along the lines of, "Mess with me and you'll get what's coming." Incidentally, in the latter part of October, when Frederick was marching southwards to take on the French, a strange incident had occurred. A Hungarian general by the name of Count András Hadik, who at the time was serving in the Austrian army, seemingly on his own initiative, decided to lead a raiding party of several thousand hussars directly towards an unprotected Berlin. When he arrived at the Prussian capital, he occupied part of it and threatened the rest unless he received a sizable ransom. Of course, when Frederick heard about this, he sent a large detachment of troops northwards. But when they arrived in Berlin, Hadik and his hussars, who by now had received their money, had simply disappeared into thin air. Anyway, after their defeat at Rossbach, the French certainly took notice, and for the rest of the Seven Years' War, they never again sent their troops into battle with the Prussians. The British were greatly impressed with their allies' performance, so impressed, in fact, that they A, increased the amount of money and material that they were sending to Frederick, and B, and this was key, they revoked the agreement that had seen Hanover removed from the war. And the Austrians? Well, they probably didn't get to hear the message until it was too late, and that's because after the Battle of Rossbach, Frederick immediately left the scene and led his troops on a forced march towards Breslau to intercept the Austrian army that was heading into Silesia. Part 1 of the Prussian king's revised plan had turned up trumps. Now it was time to put Part 2 into action, and exactly 1 month later, On December the 5th, 1757, the Prussians and the Austrians face one another near the small Silesian town of Leuthen. And like Memel, if you try to find either Breslau or Leuthen on a modern map, you won't, because today they're in Poland and they have slightly different names. Once again, the Prussian army would be significantly outnumbered. Frederick had managed to supplement his forces with troops based in Silesia, and so now the Prussian army stood at around 36,000 men. However, the Austrian army was almost twice its size, at approximately 66,000. And this time around, Frederick would be facing an Austrian army that A, had one person in overall command, Maria Theresa's brother-in-law, Prince Charles of Lorraine, and B, was known for its toughness and professionalism. But the Austrians and their reputation in 7 hours of fierce fighting were simply blown away. Frederick again had chosen his ground carefully, and he'd positioned large numbers of men behind a series of low hillocks. And then, during the actual battle itself, via a cleverly executed diversion, he'd managed to convince Prince Charles for at least 2 hours that the main action was taking place on the Austrian right, whereas in reality it was all taking place on the Austrian left. And by the time Charles had twigged that he'd been duped, it was too late. Entire Austrian regiments were captured, and others simply deserted in droves. Austrian losses were significant, around 3,500 dead, 6,000 to 7,000 wounded, and 12,000 to 15,000 were either captured or simply ran away. Frederick considered Leuthen to be the greatest victory of his military career, but having said that, Prussian losses were also significant, with around 6,000 killed, wounded, or captured, and the Prussian king would also later admit that his triumph was down to a huge slice of luck. Plus, Frederick had missed a trick by allowing the remnants of the Austrian army to escape to safety in Bohemia. Prince Charles and his second-in-command, Joseph von Dorn, were completely devastated by the loss and the manner of the defeat. They just simply couldn't work out where they'd gone wrong. In the end, Maria Theresa decided to bump Prince Charles upstairs. He would become the governor of the Habsburg Netherlands, and she promoted von Dorn to overall command of the Austrian forces. After the battle, Frederick marched his forces to nearby Breslau and successfully laid siege to the city. And on December the 20th, the Austrian garrison, seeing that the writing was on the wall, surrendered. So, parts 1 and 2 of the Prussian king's revised master plan each had a massive tick against them. And with his reputation as the foremost military genius of the age even further enhanced, he moved on to part 3. Frederick, sensing correctly as it happens that any further Russian military activity was unlikely before the new year, moved the bulk of his eastern forces away from East Prussia and into Pomerania, and very quickly managed to drive the Swedes back to the coast and blockaded the main Swedish city of Stralsund. Oh, and if you look up Stralsund on a map, this time you'll be in luck. And so in a matter of just 8 weeks, the Prussian king had managed to completely turn the tables on three of its four adversaries. As previously stated, France would never again raise an army against Prussia. The Swedes were bottled up in Stralsund, and the Austrians had abandoned Silesia. Incidentally, Frederick had hoped that his victories at Rossbach and Leuthen would bring Maria Theresa to the treaty table, begging for peace and prepared to give up Austria's claim to Silesia. But in this, he was to be disappointed, as Maria Theresa, for the time being, did nothing and said nothing. A bonus for Frederick, though, was Great Britain's decision to rip up its agreement with France regarding Hanover, and then agree with Frederick that one of his own commanders, Duke Ferdinand of Brunswick, was to take overall control over what was left of the Hanoverian army. At this stage, it's hard to see how Frederick's position could have been any better. Okay, the Russians still held Memel and some territory in the far eastern part of Prussia, and of course his capital had been briefly occupied. But these were nothing more than minor embarrassments. And so as 1757 drew to a close, the Prussian king was a very happy man. Okay, that will be that for this episode. Join me next time when we'll be taking a pause from the excitement of the Seven Years' War and looking instead at the fallout back in Russia from Apraxin's retreat. Until then, dear patrons and listeners, keep your heads up, yes, up this time, and not down. And in these somewhat worrying times, remember to look after yourselves, and of course, to stay as safe as you possibly can.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at Aura.com/safety. That's AURA.com/safety.